Another beautiful day for practice, don't you think? It's remarkable. And I want to begin just by reminding all of us, reminding you what an opportunity we have. Again, don't you think that we have an entire day that we can devote to simply being present? Devoting to this practice of actually being here for our lives in some kind of manner. And I'm always struck by it because it really is a rare thing. I mean, how often do we take this time of having an entire day devoted to something like this? In light of that, I invite you to make the best use of our day together. And this morning, what I wanted to do is I wanted to review a little bit of what we went over yesterday, and then I want to add on a few more facets of what we're exploring, namely this teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness that come from this discourse by the Buddha entitled the same thing. It's called the Satipatthana Sutta, or the four foundations of mindfulness. And as I was saying yesterday, it is, you could say, probably the single most important discourse in terms of the Vipassana movement. So it really is very important. And not only in terms of the Vipassana movement, but just in terms of our understanding of mindfulness, even in this, even in the modern usage of it. You might have remembered I shared with you these four foundations, these four arenas, basically, that we bring this quality of presence, this quality of being mindful. And I shared with you the first foundation, which really was the essence of what we were doing yesterday, which was this quality of mindfulness of the body. And in the discourse itself, and for those of you who are going to be doing this study group, again, there's going to be a study group on Thursday nights in May, if you're interested in looking at this teaching more in depth. And in the discourse, in this mindfulness of the body, he has a number of different practices just under this heading. And I'm simplifying it more in terms of simply sensation, and it, which would fit really into the experience of what he would call the elements within the body. And I'm not going to get into that because it's kind of complex and it's a different kind of language. Yet in the Buddha's time, the understanding of the elements, you know, earth, air, wind, and fire, and the experience of those internally, I think, was very familiar with practitioners. So it was an easy language to use. I think the comparable language that we have is the language of sensation. And I was inviting you to become curious about all the different kinds of sensations. Have you noticed what a huge variety of sensations there are? It's a trip, you know, tingling, pulsing, vibration, various kinds of itches. There can be hot and cold, dry, sweaty, all these various kinds of sensations, from tight to relaxed in terms of musculature. And again, what I invite you to do is to continue to have this curiosity about this vast world of sensation. So we're taking one aspect of this mindfulness of the body that the Buddha speaks about in this discourse. And again, as I was mentioning, and I'm sure many of you have noticed, it's incredible how we live in a culture or a society where we're rather disembodied. This quality of disconnection. And a lot of it is because of the way we view the body. This can be especially for women, right? In terms of there can be such a huge, like actually now for men as well, this imposition of how bodies should look like. Which is so ridiculous, right? There's such a variety, and yet there's this push for these certain images of what a body should look like. And what a oppressive thing to bring into our minds. For example, they did a study with young teenage women, and young teenage women that had more of a propensity of reading magazines, you know, magazines that portrayed these images of the perfect female body, were more likely to be unhappy. to say the least, and would lead to body image issues, which I find, again, so striking in terms of this taking in a lot of what society gives us. And I think what happens is we start to disconnect from our bodies, and there's so much wisdom within our bodies that we want to sense into. And in particular, the wisdom that I was inviting you to touch into was this wisdom about impermanence, that it's this vehicle to really get a feeling sense of impermanence and how to be in harmony with it. And today I invite you to do the same thing, to have the basis of your meditation still be in sensation, either with the breath, the abdomen rising and falling as you breathe in and out, or at the nostrils, or engaging in this body scan that I was speaking about yesterday as well. And again, if you need refresher or details about those, or any questions about that, we can talk about that during the first walking meditation period. I guess one short story about this. After my Zen practice, I started doing these retreats, these Goenka retreats. Has anybody done a Goenka retreat here? Who's done a Goenka retreat? Oh, interesting. Huh. Usually there's always one person that's done a Goenka. There are these 10-day retreats that have a very specific way of unfolding. And it's all about, you start for the first 3 days of just paying attention to the breath, and then the remaining aspect of the retreat is just scanning through the body. So you're spending, you know, 7-8 days just doing this body scan. And it is so amazing to spend that kind of time just with sensation. And it's very, very particular. It's only sensation. That's all they want you to pay attention to. But I really got hooked on doing them. I did about 8 or 9 in a very short period of time. I think it really changed my relationship to my body. In the sense of, it's so much easier now just to have a sense of my body, and I'm so grateful for that. It's like, oh, here I am. It was this process of re-inhabiting the body. It's so important. That was the first foundation. And then the second foundation, which you might remember that I shared with you yesterday afternoon, was this foundation of the Pali word is Vedana, which again is usually translated as feeling tone. It's those three flavors. I usually like to think about it more in terms of the flavors of experience. And noticing this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. As the Buddha says, and he gives a wonderful analogy to this. He says, in the sky practitioners, various kinds of winds are blowing. Winds from the east, west, north, and south. Winds carrying dust, and winds without dust. Winds hot and cold, some winds gentle and fierce. Similarly, practitioners, there arise in this body various kinds of feeling tones. Pleasant feelings arise, painful feelings arise, and neutral feelings arise. I appreciate that analogy with the wind. And what I appreciated about it is to reflect on, I have no control over the wind. And my spiritual practice is not about controlling the wind. Yet, in my life, maybe you're like me, I find that my mind wants to control the wind a lot. Yet it isn't. Some days are sunny, some days are cloudy. And that's not within my control. What's in my control, or what I'm most interested about, is my relationship to the wind. And this is what you might have noticed when we were talking about this yesterday, is this is what gets exemplified in this teaching about Vedana, or feeling tone, is what's your relationship to what's arising? Because that's where the freedom is. Not what is going on, but how you're relating to it. This is really essential. So it's not what is going on, it's how the mind is relating to it. And I want to point out, yes, there's this caveat, which is really important. If you're cold and you have a jacket, of course you're going to put on a jacket. If you're warm and you have a jacket on, of course you're going to take it off. If you have heat in your house, you turn the heat up when it's cold. Or you cool down the house when it's hot. There's things that we can do to adjust our experiences. And this spiritual practice is not about stopping to do those things. So of course we're going to continue to do those things. Have you noticed that's not where our problems lie? Our problems lie around the things that there's not a thermostat for right there in the room. Our problems around the emotions or the situations that arise that you don't have a choice about. There's no jacket to put on to help you with it, or jacket to take off. And there's only one choice, which is, how are you going to relate to it in a skillful way? And it's noticing around those situations when you try to avoid it, try to avoid the feeling of grief or anger rather than simply be with it, you suffer more. Does this make sense, the realm that we're talking about? We're not here to get extreme about all this. We're here to find a way to a deep sense of happiness. And the other thing that you might have noticed is that within this, what we start to realize is that there's a difference between that which is unpleasant or painful and that and the experience of suffering or discontent. And this is a really important distinction, and a distinction that we want to start to become curious about. For example, there's a meditation teacher by the name of Shinzen Young, and he's, as the words he would use, he's quite nerdy, so he loves mathematics. Says he has a book about calculus near his toilet. That's what he reads. We all have different reading material. So he has this great equation to explain this. He says that suffering equals pain times resistance, which when you think about it, is a wonderful description of really what suffering is. Suffering's not only pain, it's the resistance that's there together with the pain. And that's what creates the fabric of our discontent or our dis-ease. Which actually means that there can be a level of pain, let's say you have a pain of 100, but there's actually no resistance to it. How much suffering is there going to be? Zero, right? 100 times zero is zero, or 10 times zero is zero. No resistance, no suffering. So if that is taken out of the equation, there's no longer any dis-ease. Or if there's pain and there's a less amount of resistance, there's going to be less suffering. Does this make sense in terms of the equation? I think it fits really well with what we're exploring here. And again, I invite you to just be curious about this again today. Can you notice when there's simply just an unpleasant experience, when there's less resistance or no resistance in that experience compared to when there's an unpleasant experience and there's resistance to it, and to notice the dis-ease or suffering from it? This is something to explore or experiment with. Is this true? And can you get a taste of how they're different, that which is unpleasant and that which is filled with dis-ease? This is why this teaching on Vedana is so important. And it can be the same with pleasure. A lot of times what happens is that when a pleasant experience arises, there's a kind of resistance. It's not so much a resistance, it's more of a grasping. It's a friction with it. And as a result, we're ill at ease. We're not completely at ease with the pleasant experience. It's actually more difficult to see it because we don't equate our discomfort or our discontent around pleasure a lot. We equate it much more easily around that which is painful or unpleasant. So it's a more difficult experience to notice. Yet it's there. The story I tell about this is when I was in Burma and I was on a retreat, and the food in Burma or Myanmar was very simple. Overcooked vegetables, and they would sometimes serve meat, mutton. And one day a donor had donated, because all the food is donated. It's really incredible. Again, it's just by the generosity of people that want to support the practice. And in Myanmar, people, there's not a lot of wealth in that country. I think it might be changing now, but still, not a lot of wealth. And somebody had donated some money to offer chocolate ice cream to all the practitioners, all the monks and yogis there. And it was Burma. I hadn't had chocolate ice cream in a long time, and I love chocolate ice cream, and it was hot. And there, my scoop of chocolate ice cream was sitting, melting. And of course, the first decision I made is the wise and skillful thing to do would be to eat my chocolate ice cream before I eat anything else. I don't think it was really filled with wisdom, but I deluded myself into that. And I remember after eating it, I wanted the chocolate ice cream so much that I wasn't even there for the experience. It was a real tragedy. The wanting had colored over the experience so much that I couldn't be with that, simply be with that which is pleasant. You might notice this around your experiences. They can be so pleasant that we get lost in them, that we want more of it, and then we're not there. I mean, it can even be out here. You're out in this pleasant setting, and the mind can start to spin off of, oh, I need to go camping more. Oh, I need to do more retreats outside. Or, oh, whatever the story is. And it's a way of kind of, there's a kind of friction with the pleasant experience. It's not simply being with it. Have you noticed this in the mind? You know, it can be around just a subtle, pleasant experience. Again, and when there's that, there's a quality of discontent. Again, do you see the importance of this teaching of Vedana, of feeling tone? If we can be aware of that, we can be aware of what the mind heaps on top of the primary experience. Another teaching the Buddha gives around this is a practitioner asks him, so what's the difference between a skilled practitioner, a gifted practitioner on this path, and just a run-of-the-mill person? I mean, don't both a run-of-the-mill person and a skilled practitioner, don't both of them feel pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings or neutral experiences? And the Buddha said, that's a great question, and it's true. A skilled practitioner also feels pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, just as a run-of-the-mill person would. And he said the difference is what happens with just a run-of-the-mill person is that a painful feeling arises. Yet the experience doesn't stop there. The mind complicates it. And what the mind does is it heaps on top of that painful experience or unpleasant experience, the reactivity, the resistance, the not wanting, which creates the suffering. And he said it's as if a person were shot with an arrow, yet the person isn't only shot with one arrow, the arrow of an unpleasant experience. Another arrow comes, a second arrow. The arrow, really, of mental anguish. Yet with a skilled practitioner, there is the first arrow of the unpleasant experience. But what's not heaped on top of it is the second arrow of mental anguish. And the same with a pleasant experience. A skilled practitioner just is able to have more of this capacity just to be with the primary experience without as much of the second arrow of complication. And you might notice this around all kinds of experiences in your life. You're having some difficulty with a person in your life at work or at home. You could, in some ways, to get a sense of this teaching, you could say that's the first arrow. Life's difficult. You have challenges in your life. You don't get to choose that. Yet the mind, have you noticed how the mind can complicate that and to shoot the second arrow that brings so much of the suffering? When you become sensitive to just acknowledging the difficulties in life, or sometimes it can be unpleasant, a lot of times it can prevent the second arrow really taking hold or lodging. Does this make sense? And again, it's the same with pleasant, as I was explaining. We can complicate the simple, full experience of that which is pleasant with that second arrow of these mental complications.